Welcome to the Onyx Pathcast. I'm one of your hosts, Eddie Webb, and with me are Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And Matthew Dawkins.
Hello there.
And today we have another one of our interviews. This is one of the old school, as it were, White Wolf people, Justin Achille. This is, frankly, a lot of fun because Justin and I worked together for a number of years back when CCP merged with White Wolf, but I was also a fan of his work beforehand, just purely from an outside perspective. And then he's since gone on to do some really cool stuff in the video game industry. So I think this is a lot of chance for us to talk about not only Vampire the Masquerade, but also some of the other stuff that he talked a lot about, like, working on Star Trek Bridge Crew, which is a VR game, and also things like the Rage collectible card game. That stuff really... He's got a very interesting career, honestly, and he's a very interesting person. I've really enjoyed talking to him.
I just hope that we get some 90s White Wolf war stories. Like, I have heard enough from some of the, like, old guard that, Justin probably got some really great stories, and probably some that aren't appropriate for air.
Some people would say Justin is a 90s White Wolf horror story.
He certainly has a reputation, let's say. But some of it is undeserved. But at the same time, I think we could probably do an entire episode of just like people like Rich and Mike Chaney and whatnot, and just talking about stories. Do like 2 hours of them telling stories and cut out down to an hour of actual airable content.
Yeah, I mean, if we cut out some of the, more salacious details, it might be okay. But you have to buy them drinks at conventions to get those stories. So
exactly right. Yeah, man, it's the special DLC.
Hey, we're all gonna be at Midwinter, and there's drinks.
It's true.
we could
coax some stories out of some of them.
Does this mean we should do a live a podcast in person? Actually, that's not that special, is it? We do it every time there's a panel at a convention. So, you know what? I thought, this is a great idea. We'll all be in the same place at the same time. Yeah, so big deal.
Well, no, actually, I do think that we should, do... because once again, Dixie and I did not get a chance to just chat between ourselves at PAX because it was... Gen Con-ish levels of busy. But Midwinter's so much more relaxed. I do think the three of us could probably get together pretty easily and just chat.
Mm. Yeah, pretty much. It could be fun. I mean, we could definitely like set up a mic like in the bar or something too and just like hang out.
That's true.
Spilling the secrets of the Onyx Path Summit. Well, maybe not.
I mean, one milestone we have not reached is a podcast yet. I mean, we've reached the milestones of accidentally deleting an episode. Actually recording over an episode, awkwardly silenced on some episodes. We haven't done a drunk episode.
It's true. It's been talked about a couple times. There were people, I think even Justin was saying something a while back on Twitter, like, yeah, we'll have to have drinks. But we honestly recorded this on a Sunday morning. It seemed like an inappropriate time to be drinking.
Right.
I was like, I don't like, drinking before noon, typically, unless it's brunch.
Then let's go into the episode while we refresh our drinks, and we'll meet at the other end. And we're here, it's Eddie Webb, and we're here with Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And our guest today is Justin Achille.
Hello.
Justin is mainly known by a lot of people on this podcast, likely as his work on Vampire the Masquerade. But he's also worked on a lot of Chronicles of Darkness stuff. He's worked on stuff in the video game industry. We've worked together for 5 or 6 years at CCP. So there's a lot to kind of take into. You have a very checkered career, shall we say.
Did you just say that our guest was a checkered past in the first, minute of recording?
Why did I even agree to this?
I mean, to be fair, you have a reputation, which is, I think, sometimes largely undeserved, but not entirely. I do want to talk a little bit about how this all started. I mean, if I remember correctly, you started off in Vampire live action before you moved into White Wolf. Is that right?
Yeah, way back in the 90s, the early 1990s, back when there were 90s, I had been out of games for a while and ended up getting back into them because a woman I was dating at the time had an interest in Anne Rice, and I did as well, so we kind of had that in common in the first place. And then she says also, oh, hey, there's this game where that lets you play vampires. And I thought, oh, I bet I know what kind of game that is. And so, you know, looked into that, and eventually it led us into some LARPing. And as we were playing these various LARPs, we ended up meeting Mike Tinney, who was in charge of the, what was it, Night Owl then?
Yeah, right.
That got rolled into White Wolf. Mm-hmm. And so after having done a few LARPs with him, he called me up when he switched over to working on the Rage collectible card game mm-hmm. project.
Okay.
And he brought me in from there. So my introduction to White Wolf is through, obviously, the pen and paper and LARP game, but my first actual project working on for White Wolf was the Rage card game.
And what was that experience like working on Rage?
It was sort of a heyday of collectible card games where anybody with any idea could print a game and any chain or hobby store would pick it up. Right. So there was, you know, it was really the Wild West at that point. But I thought we had a really cool advantage because the quality of the cards then was so high for Rage.
Yeah.
We did it through Upper Deck, and they had, you know, the UV coating on the card, and they had a little hologram verifying the official card. And we kind of built on that, doing the chase cards for the past lives for werewolves and for, you know, for other pieces of the game there. So it was really cool to be doing it in terms of the quality of the game we were making, in terms of the design for the game we were making. It was also very much a kind of beer and pretzels sort of, oh, everyone's throwing cards out at the table at once. It was very much a you know, kind of party game that sort of felt like, you know, LARP sometimes gets that way as well when there's a lot going on, and this mm-hmm. sort of kind of scratched that itch for me as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, like, when I talk to people about how they get into the hobby, and a lot of people's like, oh, you know, I played Jihad or Vampires Don't Struggle, but for me, it was Rage. I remember playing a lot of Rage at that time, and you're right, it's a very different experience, and it's, to a degree, I think it's a little bit of a shame that people don't talk more about Rage, because it was a genuinely clever, fast-paced card game that just doesn't get a lot of attention, and you're right, it was that kind of glut of everyone's making a card game at that time.
I think it was pretty different from a lot of other card games too, which were very structured and very built for that kind of organized play or competitive play, whereas
right.
Rage was more like, hey, hang out with your friends and talk smack with one another and, you know, throw cards and it's all a good time. It was more like a party game, I guess, than a, you know, kind of traditional CCG.
Absolutely, and I always felt like my experience definitely was around a college campus, and so people would just take their decks with them and sit down at a table and just play a quick game, which was so that party game kind of ad hoc play was very much at least my personal experience with it. So that's actually really cool, and I've never really talked about the Rage stuff. And was Rage the game where you had the art note about the clown being torn in half?
Yes, that was some of my object lessons in doing art notes. I had come onto Rage doing customer service and eventually moved into, once Mike moved out of designing Rage proper and moved into working more on Arcadia, the Wild Hunt, I ended up doing a lot of the design on Rage, the Rage card game. And I remember doing the card in question there was the Zmei, this, you know, giant legendary dragon. And it was the toughest monster we had in the game. And it had these crazy stats that were just completely through the roof. And then my art notes for it were, you know, very conversational, very colloquial. The art note was this giant dragon biting some clown in half. And that's exactly what I got. I got a dragon biting a literal clown in half. And he was, you know, holding a little horn that said honk honk because he was, you know, making squeaky noises. So and that's one of the things that I'm both I guess humbled by, but also kind of glad I had the opportunity to learn it that way, because Rich Thomas was the art director on that, and he let that go, and he gave me exactly what I asked for, and I never did that again.
Yeah, one of the things that I've learned just from my early dev projects is that artists can be very literal. So you have to be very literal sometimes when you describe what you want from them. So,
and you know, I totally understand it too, because they don't want to go through multiple iterations of, well, did he really mean clown? And I gave him a clown. And he, well, it says clown. He doesn't, you know, the artist doesn't necessarily want to interpret that and then submit art and have it get unapproved and have to go back and do more work, you know, because these guys, the card sets were anywhere between like 90 and 150, you know, upwards of 400 cards sometimes. And so if you're doing, you know, 15 cards and you have to go back and redo 10 of them, that's a lot of extra work. So it's just easier for the designer or developer to actually write down what they want. And so that was, you know, pretty much my mantra going forward. My art notes always for the tabletop games, for the Vampire supplements, always ended up emphasizing often architecture or positioning of characters. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of make a single vampire standing there looking cool. Instead, it was, you know, put it in this setting in the book, or, you know, show us these two vampires running away from this mob of vampires because we have the anarchs are furious in this chapter. You know, so it was much more representational the further along we got into it.
Absolutely. I know Rich, when I was starting to learn art notes, he was very much kind of the mantra of each of these pieces, someone should be doing something, unless it's specifically a portrait, like, you know, for a stat block or a character sheet. Otherwise, character should be doing something in that space. So we kind of migrated. Did you have any tabletop stuff before Vampire, or is it just kind of rage right into Vampire? Was there a progression there?
I went from Rage to doing a little bit of Arcadia. I wouldn't even say co-design. It was more playtesting and just giving a couple ideas. The card department then was... we never really got bigger than 5 full-time staffers in the design side. Uh-huh. So, you know, it was always a chance to work on someone else's project as well as kind of, you know, shepherd your own. But then once I moved out of cards, I first, for a period of time, I want to say probably a year and a half, 2 years, did Vampire the Dark Ages. Because that had been back when Jennifer Hartshorn was running Vampire.
Right.
Vampire Dark Ages came out as this big kind of freestanding supplement for it, and it sold well enough that they wanted to blow it up into its own line. So there was kind of a new position that opened up there, and I was really lucky to be on hand to be able to take that. And also that kind of inherited some of the other historical lines that we wanted some support for, but they weren't like full-fledged. You know, so I got to do Werewolf the Wild West and, you know, little bits and pieces here and there of other stuff. But then once Rob Hatch moved out of Vampire and into developing what became Exalted, you know, after he did the revised edition, which was kind of his swan song for Vampire, I moved into that, and then it was all Vampire, 100% from there on for me.
Yeah, because Vampire is really its own beast. I've learned from my own experiences. Like, I feel like if you're working other game lines, you can kind of dip in and out, but once you're at the helm of Vampire, it's such a I don't want to say dense property, but there's a lot going on with there. There's a lot of things you have to kind of stay on top of, and it really feels like you kind of have to just really focus on that. Is that your experience as well?
Very much so. In fact, there were times when, because it is it's probably the most accessible of the World of Darkness games, just because, you know, a vampire the White Wolf Vampire is probably the least specific of kind of the World of Darkness critters. You know, Mage is very specific with its spheres, and Werewolf with its you know, auspices. And there's a lot you kind of take in the cosmology that you just don't have to worry about in Vampire. Mm-hmm. So often Vampire ended up having the most supplements. Like, I remember one year there were 10 books on the schedule, and I literally could not do 10 books in a year. So, you know, other developers come in to help kind of pinch hit on Vampire. Mm-hmm. Like, I know Ethan did some of the clan books back in the day.
Yep.
So, you know, just there's so much there that one person literally couldn't handle it all back at its peak.
It's an interesting kind of, again, relationship, because there is so much out there. And like I said, it's very accessible. So you kind of always have to keep in, at least I always felt like you have to keep in mind of, like, okay, but what vampire movies can be done with this? And, you know, can I do Lost Boys with this? Can I do, you know, Bram Stoker's with this? Can I do blah, blah, blah? And whereas the other games, because you're right, Werewolf is its own distinct take on werewolves, Mage's own distinct take on mages, it doesn't really have to necessarily cleave to the breadth of fiction involving those protagonists.
Yes, yes, I agree with you there. In fact, at the time, I think we weren't even trying to be as broad as that. A lot of the effort for Masquerade was to make Masquerade very distinctly Masquerade, at least under my early stewardship.
Oh, okay.
And then, like, toward the latter part of it, you know, when you and I worked together on V20, it was 180 degrees, right? It was like, yeah, sure, tell whatever vampire story you want. Yeah, do Lost Boys. Yeah, do Blade. You know, anything you kind of wanted to there. I felt like there was a real tipping point, and you could kind of observe, not necessarily through Vampire, but just through kind of how players were playing the game. You know, we had Usenet back in the day, and that was really the only good exposure you had to kind of day-to-day what people were doing with things. And there were, you know, collections of things here and there, things like the BJ Zanzibar site, and like, oh, well, this is getting a little over the top. I'm going to steer Vampire more toward a kind of distinctly, you know, self-contained vampire element. But now, you know, when you publish a game, your your input on it ends the moment you put it in a player's hands, right? And that just has become very, very visible of late. And, you know, now more than ever with people streaming, you get kind of firsthand, oh, here's how people are playing the game. And we were operating basically in a vacuum early on. But by the time we did, you know, V20, all that stuff was very, very evident. And I mean, I remember even going back into the rules chapter, and at one point we were going to change the botch rules to fix them. And we put them out in playtest, and players did not want the botch rules fixed. Right? Like, they wanted these mechanically broken things that nonetheless kind of reminded them of the time, like, oh, yeah, back, you know, 15 years ago when we were playing this, you know, you could botch the better you got at something, and it made these ridiculous situations, and they wanted that. So, okay. I mean, I thought my job was to fix this, but if this is what you guys want, great. Here you go.
Yeah, there is definitely a heavy dose of, like, nostalgia that I think flavors a lot of people who still play some of these games. Because, yeah, that's what I found with both Vampire and Exalted and a few other things. Every now and then we're like, oh, we're going to change this. And they're like, but we like it broken. We're like, okay, we'll leave it broken. Enjoy.
And that's such a tough line to straddle, because, you know, people want something new. And they want something new because it gives them something more to do, but they also want it, like you say, to cleave very closely to... I don't know that... Yes, V20 was definitely a nostalgia title, but you can't just keep reserving that same stuff over and over.
Right.
You know, because then, obviously, and deservedly so, players resent that because you're just, you know, sending them the same thing over and over. So where is the line? And that's something that, you know, needs to be answered by game and by supplement and by community. You know, what do the individual players want? It's...
One of the big... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's just... It's puts more demand, I think, on a developer. And since you guys are more... actively developing, you know, I do maybe one title a year or so, or do some freelancing here and there. You guys see it way more firsthand, and there you go. You can have it. Good luck.
I was going to say, one of the biggest misconceptions that I run into at conventions and also online sometimes is that the 20th anniversary editions are just reprints of, like, first edition or revised or something. And it's like, no, we rewrote the whole game. Like, we fixed rules, we put it all in one book, we added things people wanted. Like, Changeling 20, Wraith 20, they're completely different beasts from the ones I was playing in, you know, high school. Also, if anybody's wondering why I've been so quiet, it's because they're talking about stuff that was literally happening when I was 10 years old. I wasn't allowed to play Rage. I was only allowed to play Magic. I was only allowed to play Magic the Gathering and a couple other card games because the other ones looked too scary, according to my mother. And then as far as, like, Vampire goes, I couldn't afford most of these supplements because I was like 15 when I was playing, so I pretty much had the core book, and that was it.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I mean, at the time, everyone who was doing development work was in their 20s. You know, this wasn't like now. You know, look at all the gray I got in my beard. I'm 45 now. I mean, I was doing this stuff 20 years ago, and I didn't know what I was doing. I was 25 years old, and I was drunk a lot of the time, so it was just a very impressionistic sort of development style where, you know, you kind of look and take your best guess as to what people want, and over time, you know, of course you refine it and you get better at it, but, you know, there was no kind of curriculum to study for a designer or developer then that was immediately relatable to tabletop RPGs. You know, you took some bits of video game knowledge and some bits of, you know, being a GM and running around the table and some bits of, you know, card game and board game design. But, you know, at that point, even when we were number two in the market and D&D was still number one, of course, there wasn't a lot of stuff you could look to by way of anything other than example. You know, you couldn't take a class on this sort of stuff except, you know, in very rare circumstances, very, very rare events.
And yeah, I mean, go ahead.
Okay, well, I was just gonna say, like, I'm 33 and I still feel that. Like, I do not, you know, there isn't a manual that I was given when I took over for Rose Bailey. Like, I've learned a lot from just pinging Eddie randomly at like 3 p.m. on a Tuesday and going, Eddie, help. Eddie, I don't know what's happening right now. And I've, you know, from watching other people and from listening to Rose for a few years, but like, as far as the design part, I'm learning by doing, essentially. So it's more like an apprenticeship than it is, you know, an actual job you can go get a degree in.
Excellent. And I mean, that actually ties into something else I want to kind of dig into a little bit is, it's one thing, like you say, there's no manual for this stuff. But also when creative sessions are coming down that nobody has done before, like, we're going to stop making this game and make a new game that's kind of like it when you go into what was then called the New World Darkness. Yeah, I mean, that must have been a chaotic and crazy time, too, doing Requiem and the core blue book for World Darkness.
Yeah, this is one of the... I remember doing it. We went on an offsite to kind of brainstorm, okay, what are we going to do next? Because we knew in terms of financial reality that the sales had tapered off. There was a market contraction around that time. So we needed to do something new to invigorate the game. And it couldn't just be a new edition because we had done comparatively recently the revised edition. So, you know, what do we do? And I remember going to the clubhouse at the then sales director's apartments. So, you know, we went to like a literal clubhouse at the front of an apartment complex, and everybody brought food, and we just had this kind of multi-day session describing where we saw the shortfalls and what kind of creative license we had to do something new. And it was really a agonized birth, I want to say, of the what became the New World of Darkness and is now the Chronicles of Darkness, because we just didn't know how much room we had to change things. I did a podcast recently where I was talking about this very thing, and one of the regrets I have is that Requiem didn't really step far enough away from Vampire, and we sort of saw that as the players played it. They thought, oh, well, this is just kind of a little bit changed, you know, kind of depending on your take on it, but obviously, you know, Werewolf and Mage got much, much further away from their first edition, but, you know, the classic World of Darkness roots and changing as well. And so Vampire, kind of the first one to sort of step into that space, I really wish I would have been bolder for it. But again, you know, it's a time when I'm young and I don't know how much room I have to do with this. And, you know, we want it still to be recognizable as Vampire, but we also want to change it enough that it justifies people being able to, you know, or us asking them to buy an entirely new game for it. So, you know, if I could go back in time, I would really push us further with that.
Yeah, and I mean, again, that's got to be terrifying because, I mean, it's not just a new edition. It's you're basically rebooting everything. And like you say, it's like if you go too far away, there's that fear that people will go, oh, this is good for company, or I don't even recognize this game. You know, whereas the other way, you know, if you stay too close, you get that kind of same old. I remember it was soon after that, but we did the, I came on board by the time we were doing the Monty Cook's World Darkness take, which was radically different. And I think to a degree unjustifiably, it was really kind of condemned because it was such a radical departure from what people knew. But I think in retrospect, it's actually a halfway decent game for what it was accomplishing, which is a very specific vision and all in one book thing. But yeah, so I mean, it's a terrifying thought to go, okay, how far can we go? And I'm sure it must have been a lot of conversations about what you can and can't do.
And it's also, I mean, honestly, it's the flagship property, right? And if I fuck it up, people lose their job and go hungry. So, you know, there's always that kind of anxiety of, okay, we have to do this right. And we had a lot of, there was a lot of confidence that came out of closing down the original run on the World of Darkness. You know, we went through three print runs of Gehenna, and, you know, some of it was kind of illusory because people who had played the game were kind of getting back into it because they knew, oh my gosh, here's a big, you know, kind of world-ending event, and they're changing the world, they're shutting it down, they're going to start it over, and they wanted to be part of it. You know, I don't think necessarily for a purely nostalgia reason, but because, you know, here's this big games event that sort of pulls them back into something that they had done previously. So, you know, we really went into it feeling very confident going forward. But again, you know, if I really wish I would have capitalized on that confidence and, you know, let it push me further. But again, not as you point out there, not so much that it becomes so very different. You know, I don't want to say Monty's wasn't unrecognizable, but it was absolutely a departure from what players expected.
Yep. Right. Yeah, I mean, I think it was unfairly characterized as unrecognizable. I think you can see the DNA there, but you're right. It's a scary thought, and that was just one book doing your company's fortunes on the new line. That's a terrifying thought. But I mean, we got through that, and like you said, the werewolf and mage kind of built on that, and then there was the merger with CCP, and you pretty quickly moved over to the MMO, right?
Well, I had quit again, I think, at that point. In 2005, I was running the editing and development department, and management is not a huge amount of what I want to do. I like getting my hands dirty in the game proper, and I like, you know, the actual making of it. So by that point, I had run that department for a year and wasn't happy with it. So I took a year off, and very shortly after I had left, I guess maybe half a year after I had left, they performed the merger with CCP. And then about half a year after that, I came back on, and that was to specifically work on the MMO. I came back to work on the MMO specifically, as opposed to continuing with the tabletop games.
Oh, okay.
I'm still sad about the MMO.
I think a lot of people are. I think that is a very frequent lament people have.
Like, one of the very, like, because I've known Rose Bailey for about a decade now, maybe even more, gosh. When we were hanging out back in Atlanta, she definitely showed me the concept art little book that y'all had.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was an avid World of Warcraft player, and I was like, this is the thing. This is the thing I want. I want my creepy dark game.
Yeah, definitely.
I talked to a couple folks about it at parties and things that I went to, you know, not any, like, NDA break and stuff, just kind of being like, hey, this is cool. And I'm still salty about it 10 years later.
You're not the only one, certainly.
Oh, I know. I know. I know there are a lot of people who are far, far saltier than me for far more reasons. But as someone who was just a fan until, you know, 3.5 years ago, I'm still... I just want to let you know that we are holding on to grudges out here.
That's an interesting turn of phrase there too. Like, I don't know that there is such a thing as just a fan. Like, the players have so much ownership of, you know, if you make a game and people don't play it, you know, you've still made it. It's still a creative expression. But, you know, when people play a game, they take, you know, they become an additional demiurge there, right? Like,
right.
You know, the story for them around that table doesn't matter if it exists in a book or is solely the creation of the GM. So, I mean, they're just a fan, just a player. I think they're a vital part of the game-playing chain there. And I think that's part of what I learned over multiple years in developing, is that, like, your player is a partner. You know, and for a long time there, Vampire got in this state where roughly 50% of the people who were buying the books were buying them not to play them, but to read them, because they were, you know, kind of trying to keep up with developments in the story. And I've said it before, and I still stand by it, that I felt like we were publishing more periodicals than we were game supplements. Yep. And, you know, now that doesn't stand, right? If you're buying something to consume it as fiction, you're probably buying fiction. But if you're buying a game, you're buying it to be a part of the game, to play it, to be part of the community. And you don't necessarily have to sit around the table and, you know, roll dice to play, to contribute. But, you know, you're doing something with that world you've bought into. And whether it's, you know, playing the game, or whether it's doing illustrations, or whether it's making podcasts or streaming or whatever it is, you know, doing something with it really puts you on some significant creative footing with the people who are publishing the game itself. I mean, look at, there's a lot of streamers who make more than, you know, developers for video games, or certainly designers and developers for tabletop games.
No, you're absolutely correct. And in trying to be, you know, self-deprecating to myself of 4 years ago, I definitely ended up sounding dismissive of the fan base, which you are totally right. Like, without fans, we would have no jobs. And, you know, also, they affect us creatively sometimes. Like, you will see things that, you know, players are doing with the games, and sometimes that gets incorporated into the game because it's a good idea, or because they've done something really interesting. Or somebody will do something that makes you go, oh, I should redesign that, or I should think about how we word that because of, you know, the confusion that it caused, or whatever.
Well, I feel like you're subtweeting me here on the Predator's Taint. Is that what's going on here?
I am not at all.
Rich is still mad about that, by the way.
Who was still mad about that? What?
Rich.
I'm sorry.
Oh. It was actually, there was a conversation when Rich had asked Rose to kind of start thinking about, we were going to take the second edition of Requiem, and he kept coming back to that one. It's like, going, no one likes Predator's Taint. No one likes Predator's Taint. I'm like, okay, so I've played Requiem, and it's not entirely true. And he's like, yeah, but whatever. No one likes it. So I'm being hyperbolic here, but I remember that specifically that kind of came up a lot. It was kind of a weird touchstone. It was like the throwing rules for Scion. It was like such a weird thing for people to gravitate to fan base. But you're right. I mean, that this stuff, you know, like you mentioned for V20, it's like the fans do take ownership of odd corners of these products. And then when they use them, when they're making, they're playing the games, it's like they get attached to very specific things. I remember, you know, we're actually caught up timeline-wise too, V20. You had pitched to CCP, like, we should make an actual game, because we were talking about, like, an art book or you know, album covers and posters, and you were like, no, we should make an actual game. I remember that was a strong pitch that came through. And when we started talking about it, you know, we were talking about things like font choice, how important the font choice for the headers were, and which pieces of art we were going to put in the classic books. There's a lot of discussions around that, and then some of that came from people like me and Shane DeVriest and others in the company who had come in through fandom, saying, hey, this is what we remember really gravitating strongly to. And also, you talked about like the botch rules. I remember you and I had some conversations. Like, you know, okay, I remember your first pitch was like a much stronger actual edition change. If I remember, it's like, you know, right, you could change like distinct rules, and we rolled that back because of some of the fan response we saw.
Yes, and I think as well, it was always intended to be an anniversary edition. You know, once we got the buy-in from marketing and the various production entities, it was intended to be an anniversary edition, you know, a kind of look back and saying thank you for being with us all these years, which really was the wrong place for a more aggressive new edition, you know, for a bigger cleanup. You know, we don't want to depart as radically from the stuff that the players who have been with us for 20 years are expecting. Really, I think that's kind of made it across in the limited edition, where we kind of included these testimonials from players, like, oh, I really loved this, and here's what it meant to me, and like, yeah, that's really what we want to zero in on. And, you know, seeing that kind of validated by the players as we put out the playtest materials to them, I really think we made the right decision there.
No, I completely agree. And I mean, this is also like right before Kickstarter was a thing. So we were doing like pre-orders and open development. I mean, you were a bit strong champion of that. And just stuff that for now, I think a lot of tabletop designers take for granted, but you were championing, okay, no, we need to get people out there and excited and turn it into this big event and people contribute to it. And there was a lot of interesting responses, but also some genuinely strong, enthusiastic, oh my God, this is exactly what I remember. This rule's always bugged me for years, and I'm glad you guys fixed that. Little things like when I brought in the bearing rules, and people were like, oh my God, this, you know, is great. It's just from Dark Ages. I always love this bit. But I know you and I, well, I remember the one thing, the one conversation I remember distinctly is you and I spending a long time talking about the Tremere disadvantage. Because neither of us were happy with how it was, and we had a long time debating about whether how much we should change that. How much you remember that conversation as well?
Yeah, I it was something that needed to change because, like, by comparison, it was such a kind of non-entity or easily sweep awayable. You know, the storyteller has to kind of rely on that or deliberately introduce the earlier Tremere discipline or the earlier Tremere weakness. Whereas, you know, if you're a Nosferatu, you know, you're hideously ugly, period, and you fail all these rolls and, you know, that's it. You know, it's in your face constantly. Whereas, oh, if you're not really playing a huge part of the pyramid, this may not even come into play at all. You know, it's almost a non disadvantage. But I think, you know, kind of leading back to that, seeing how the players used it, that's always been something that I think the LARP groups have had a huge benefit of, is, you know, they're running these very large scope and very, you know, they have a lot of input on people using systems and how well those systems scale and how much storyteller attention they require versus how much of that they can push into the player's hands and let the player do it. And so a lot of, at that time as well, the effort was, you know, at that point, Shane was getting the various player groups to kind of talk to one another again and give us the kind of incoming benefit of, oh yeah, these guys play frequently and here's what they have to say. So, you know, in addition to the open development, which is both a blessing and a curse, you know, we had a high volume of input, and it was from people who were already invested in it, because, you know, a lot of times when you get feedback on stuff like that, it ends up being, you know, the feedback is, oh, this system doesn't work, which really means, oh, I want the system to work like this.
Right.
And so, you know, the designer has to, or the developer has to sort of know what to set aside and what to keep. And there's definitely a greater sense of, well, these people have been playing this for 20 years and they agree with us on this. And, you know, of course, the Tremere players don't want a more severe disadvantage, right?
Right.
But everyone else kind of, I think, saw the same sort of, well, yeah, you can just kind of hand wave this away unless there's a specific focus put on it. So, you know, those are the sorts of, those are discussions definitely worth having. And, you know, they sort of change things, not, you know, terribly radically. The Tremere are still the Tremere, the hierarchy is still the hierarchy, the pyramid's still the pyramid, you know, and they're even still in the Camarilla. We didn't, you know, change any of that stuff. But, you know, those are, that's a great example of a non-system thing, or not a hugely system thing, that has kind of a cascade of effects.
Yeah, absolutely. It was for me, very enlightening, because that was the first time I had really dealt with the community in that respect. Because a lot of work I'd done previously was much more kind of on the production end, with the trying to get print on demand up and running, trying to get PDF as a concept moving, getting some developments of support products. But it was the first time I really kind of had pulled in that feedback, and I remember going to you a few times, going, "How important is this?" And you helping me to kind of gauge what that, where that importance was, which was good and which wasn't good. Or not good, but rather which was relevant to what we were trying to accomplish and which was perhaps interesting, but not what we're trying to accomplish with this product.
Right.
So that was very useful. And then you moved on to Redstorm after that point. Am I right?
2011. I had been back with CCP for 4 years at that point. We were working on the MMO, and it ended up at that point not being what I wanted it to be. You know, I was just kind of personally dissatisfied with where it was going. We were working on a lot of really cool social features, but the kind of social, you know, it was called the coffee shop when it was in development. You know, here's these kind of social spaces where players gather and sort out, you know, kind of player what they want to do. You know, there's, it lets them organize, and it lets them recognize one another, and it lets them, you know, form these structures and build their coteries or build their sects or factions. And it, that was kind of pushed to a back burner, and there was more focus on, well, we need to get the kind of quest engine running here. And I didn't really have any interest in that, so that's when I took off to head to Ubisoft. I actually went to Ubisoft Annecy at that point. Okay. Which was in France to work on Assassin's Creed Revelations. And then shortly thereafter, after shipping Revelations, came back to the U.S. to work on a couple Facebook games pretty quickly, but then back to Redstorm, which is also a Ubisoft studio, to work on some titles there.
Right, and then you started... I remember when I reconnected with you, you were at that time really heavily moving into virtual reality space and what it's just... like to make virtual reality games, and you and I reconnected at one of the East Coast Game Conferences a few years back, And you showed us at that time a werewolf, which not Werewolf the Apocalypse, but you know the card game where for each person's different role of a villager and they're bluffing. And I noticed when you're talking about it, a lot of inspiration from the live action space and how people engage with this stuff. So maybe you know, talk a little bit about kind of what Werewolf is and how you kind of designed around that.
Yeah, you're spot on there. I have always been interested in the social dynamics of player groups just as an entity. And, you know, tabletop RPGs are a great example of that because you have a kind of GM who's operating in a director's role and then players who are kind of reacting to the prompts that the GM gives them. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not even a universal truth anymore because a lot of modern design sort of pushes that kind of narrative framing onto the players and less into the bailiwick of the dictatorial GM. But just as a unit, as a social group there, you know, a group of players get together to tell stories. And so I've always been interested in video games as well, in the sort of multiplayer aspect of it. Not necessarily purely PvP, not necessarily purely PvE or co-op. And that's one of the things that we Right. really wanted to push forward as we started doing this emergent technology in VR, was how can we take these social dynamics that exist in any given game-playing space and bring them into VR. So we really pushed what we were calling social VR with the presence that you kind of inherit with VR there. And so Werewolves Within initially started as just kind of a prototype. It was kind of a proof of concept that my boss, David Vitipka, was using to illustrate to... you know, he was really pushing to get Star Trek Bridge Crew up and running, and we sort of did Werewolves right. Within as this kind of knock together, hey, here's what happens when a group of people come together, and they liked it so much that they not only approved our permission to seek Bridge Crew, which obviously we eventually produced, but also they liked the prototype so much that they said, yeah, let's polish this and put this out as well. And so there, you know, like you say, you really get to see a lot of the social dynamics, a lot of the even heavily LARP-driven mechanics. Like in Werewolves Within, there's a method by which, you know, one player can stand up and literally turn off the microphones for all the other players. So, you know, there's a way to demand everyone pay attention to me at this point. And, you know, we had a lot of, like, other really cool systemic features, things like when you look at another player, we lock your eyeballs with that other player's eyeballs, so it actually looks like you're having a communication with them, and you know, things like on the voice or on the sound side, when you look at someone and lock eyeballs with them, we increase the sound of the conversation you're having with that person, and we duck the volume of Ooh. All of the other conversations, because obviously, you know, you're looking at this person and trying to talk to them, so we kind of push away the chaff for all of the for all of that as well. Yeah, there's some stuff that carries over literally from the tabletop as well. Like, you are literally sitting in a circle in Werewolves Within, you know, around the right. fire in kind of a, you know, kind of campfire storytelling sense here. But, you know, it's very much a game influenced by games, and we kind of hide that by building it into the setting itself.
And I'm going to briefly go into metrics nerddom because my little bit of producer showing.
oh, no.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm sorry about this. But one of the things that fascinated me when you were talking to me about this is that at the time, this was, again, 2015, I want to say, the average session for VR was like 10, 15 minutes. And you said that you were finding that people were playing this game for hours. Which was fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, it was still very early in this round of commercial VR, and we had built the game around these kind of 5 to 7 minute sessions. You know, it's very short. Who's the werewolf? It's you. Okay, let's resolve it. Next game. Right. And to our surprise, people were actually sticking around for multiple next games. And mm-hmm. so the average time spent in VR was roughly 15 minutes then. But when we tested both in the lab and once we had released into live game territory, I mean, there were people, I think our longest player had something like 10 hours in a single sitting.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I mean, and all of this is kind of dictated by the form factor, right? Like, you've got this VR toaster that you have bolted to your head, and, oh, it's going to be heavy right. and uncomfortable, and you're not going to want to wear it, and you're going to want to get up and stretch your legs. Well, no. You know, the PlayStation one is probably, at that time, was probably the most comfortable one. But even the HTC Vive and the Oculus Rift, they weren't as heavy as kind of you thought they were, and you didn't notice them. So, you know, we had built the game to be, oh, you can get out of this once you start being uncomfortable. And people are like, yeah, that's cool. I'm comfortable. Let's keep going.
That's just fascinating. So you mentioned Bridge Crew. I want to touch on that a little bit because that you got this really strong social dynamic design thought through, and you moved on to Bridge Crew. Was there any challenges in adapting an existing IP's social dynamics into what you found was very gameable?
Yeah, I just want to clarify for our listeners: this is Star Trek Bridge Crew.
Oh, yes,
it's not just. Like about building bridges.
No,
like,
no, that's fair. That's a fair point. Yeah, it actually is a Star Trek branded game about being the bridge of a crew.
Extremely lucrative bridges of Madison County property. That
I just know that sometimes with like when we get to an interview with somebody that Eddie knows very well, he just kind of assumes that everybody else knows what they're talking
that's
about.
Fair.
Whereas I sometimes sit here and just Google things on my phone while people are talking. So,
I
just wanted to clarify that for the listeners.
No, I appreciate that because I do just get lost. Yeah, I was talking about the thing. So yeah, this is Star Trek Bridge Crew. That was the next big VR project, and it was the idea was each person played a member of the crew of the Enterprise or an equivalent Starfleet ship, and they were working together to resolve a mission. So there's a lot of challenges in that kind of shift to this is a property that has 50 years of it established. This is how the social dynamic works.
Yes, and that's specifically why we chose the bridge kind of arrangement specifically, as opposed to, you know, you're down in the photon torpedo bay and you're loading those. No, we specifically wanted players to be on the bridge because the bridge is that common space, you know, whereas in Werewolves Within, it's everyone sitting around the campfire. In Star Trek Bridge Crew, it's all of these bridge officers actively there on the bridge. And we built the social spaces there to really emphasize that. Even in the kind of pregame lobby, you are sitting in the briefing room, and you're sitting there with other players, and you've got, you know, these holograms in front of you, and you're operating, you know, your keyboard that's allowing you to choose your options. But you're there to discuss with the other players, hey, what mission do we want to do today? Who's going to take what role? I'm going to be captain. So, you know, we build even the kind of pregame into a social activity. And then once everybody moves onto the bridge itself, you kind of get this very different from Werewolves Within dynamic. In Werewolves Within, you are, again, sitting in a circle, and a circle has no head. There's nobody at the head of the table. So it's a very kind of democratic arrangement there. And we did that specifically so no player would inherently be the leader. Whereas in Star Trek Bridge Crew, obviously your captain is your leader. So the captain is positioned above the other officers and to the back. So the captain oversees everything that the other officers are doing so they can give them, you know, kind of additional feedback. The captain's role in Bridge Crew is to kind of pass information back and forth. And the other officers are manipulating the details of their particular station. So, you know, the helmsman controls where you're going, and the tactician operates the phasers and the photon torpedoes, and the engineer devotes energy to various needs, you know, whether the shields or the engines, things like that. But all of that needs to go through the captain, and all of those also have dependencies. So, for example, if I'm the tactician, if I'm the tactical officer, and I'm firing phasers, well, engineer, I need you to give me more power. So, you know, there's a relationship, there's a dependency on the engineer for the tactician, but the tactician also relies on the helmsman to get them close enough to these other targets, you know, whether they're shooting on them, and the tactician is all, or the tactical officer is also performing scanning, so I need you to get me close enough to this asteroid where I can get a readout on it. But the captain is the only one who knows the actual details of the mission. They're the one who gets the briefing and the kind of bullet point, you need to do this. So mm-hmm. It's kind of a big sort of game of telephone where everyone gets a little bit more input on what they're doing. You know, in terms of operating a system as opposed to just kind of passing along a piece of information. So, I mean, it's literally a game in which you succeed or fail based on your ability to operate as a crew, your ability to socialize as a common unit there. And that's, you know, something that is, again, to me, fascinating. There's so many parallels with a tabletop game there. Like, you know, if you split the party, well, everyone's going to get massacred. And it's the same thing in Bridge Crew, right? If I'm doing one thing and you're doing another thing and Tactical is firing torpedoes, we don't even have an enemy on the screen, well, what the hell are we doing? We're going to fail the mission.
Right.
No, that makes a ton of sense. And and your fascination with kind of social dynamics, and you talk repeatedly about how it stems from tabletop. So it was really exciting for me personally when you kind of went to Rich and talked about doing the Vampire the Masquerade card game Princess Gambit, which we've not talked a lot about on this podcast, actually. But really, Princess Gambit is kind of a card game distillation of both of those concepts. It's that kind of semi-cooperative, semi-competitive thing. You're trying to find the Sabbat infiltrators, but also you are working together, and each person has a distinct role, although that role changes each turn. I know a lot of that went into the design of Prince's Gambit. Was there a challenge in trying to then distill that into our card game, or was it a pretty easy change to make?
I had the benefit of, I had two objectives with Prince's Gambit, and the first one was to take the vampire experience and boil it down to an hour. Yeah. You know, here's a quintessential vampire game that you play in an hour, and it draws heavily on LARP, and it draws heavily on the kind of treachery and betrayal elements that are kind of inherent to LARP, but also reinforced in the tabletop mm-hmm. game. And then my second sort of mandate there was to build it around systems that would be largely familiar to players. Like, I didn't want to have something completely new from the ground up. And so I started with the old first edition of the Mind's Eye Theater rules that has, you know, these specific trait values. Uh-huh. And you need to have this particular quantity of traits to meet this particular challenge. Mm-hmm. And so it really is a super simplified first edition Mind's Eye Theater treatment of vampire that's playable in an hour. So, you know, that's really the intent there, is to get it all familiar systems and really illustrate that essential experience of vampire. And then just kind of as a plus, since vampire is such a social game, you know, the Prince's Gambit relies on communication between players, and, well, this player has led me along, so are they really working with me, or are they trying to get me to trust them? Because, as you say, there's, you know, always two secret Sabbat agents. The Sabbat character, well, not always two, but there's always secret Sabbat in play. Right. And so the Sabbat know who each other are, so they have perfect knowledge there, but the Camarilla players don't know who they are. And so, you know, they are trying to figure out who to trust. They have a numerical advantage, but they have an information disadvantage. And so you can kind of see here, too, that a lot of this was informed by working on Werewolves Within at the time, and that sort of imperfect information flow, and I need a player to do this, and I don't know if he's doing it to build trust with me or if he's doing it because he actually wants to succeed and help the Camarilla win. But again, you know, those social dynamics that are there, there's not a campaign mode right. for Prince's Gambit, because, you know, once you start to mistrust another player, you kind of carry that forward into the next session. You know, if everybody knows, oh, Justin's a really good liar, he's probably the Sabbat. You know, statistically, right. I'm probably not. You know, that sort of thing, when you get into, there's a lot of kind of precedent for this in terms of games or game theory exercises like the Prisoner's Dilemma. And once you do the iterated Prisoner's Dilemma, once you have the, you know, the same people seeing the consequences over multiple versions of it, they start to call it the Shadow of the Future. So, you know, because I have betrayed you three times in the past, you are inclined to think that I'm going to betray you again. Right. Even if, you know, these sessions in the future, every game stands on its own, you know, it has no relation to the previous game, but if you start expecting me to lie, then you start taking these other courses of action based on what you expect of me, as opposed to how you're reading the table. And I can fight that if I make a compelling argument to you, if I am a good social player and can convince you to trust me again. And, you know, maybe I am lying again, but, you know, maybe I'm not. Maybe I am, and probably statistically most likely am on your side, because there always are more Camarilla players. So I just started rambling there, and I think I talked about what you were asking me to. So.
You did. No, you kind of covered it. And actually, it segued into one of the things I actually do love about the Prince's Gambit. You mentioned the LARP element. Something I don't think we talk about enough is that there is a very implicit LARP veneer to it, because one of the things I got, particularly from EVE Online, is the blur between using the in-game and out-of-game mechanics fluidly. One of the things that EVE Online does really well is that you can use the in-game, the out-of-game terminology in-game, and there's no disconnect there. There's no, like, breaking character. You're using the mechanical terms inside your character play. And the same thing that Prince's Gambit does is that, you know, you have 6 to 8 people sitting around the table, and they're the Primogen Council. You have this anarch uprising, and you talk about the assets you're going to play, and it's a little vague as to whether it's you, the personal vampire, or the vampires that you control underneath of you, but it's you sitting here and talk very abstractly about really serious concerns, and then you just portray your assets as necessary and find out if it's resolved or not, and then the private council reconvenes to talk about the next outbreak and the next concern. And so even though you're sitting around a table playing cards and just talking, but that's exactly what the characters you're portraying would also be doing in that circumstance. And I found that particularly compelling when I was doing a playtest of it.
Yeah, I'm glad that's that really came across. That actually feels like the icing on the cake to me, is the game works equally well for players who want to add that additional, like, really role-playing element. You can absolutely LARP as the primogen of the clan that you are representing there, but the game doesn't rely on it as well. You know, if I am playing purely with the information that comes across the table, I can do that as well. And so it's interesting to me to see you draw the parallel with Eve there, because Eve is obviously very results-driven, and you don't have to role-play, even though it is an MMORPG. You don't have to pretend that you actually are the captain of this spaceship. You can if you want to, but really it's about the results that you're generating there. And in a lot of cases, those results are helped be framed by the outcomes. You know, when we are, oh, the Sabbat really got away with it again, you know, we kind of imagine in our mind, you know, the city going to hell and there's all these fires going on because the Sabbat are running rampant. And so, you know, it kind of lets us fill in the blanks. It helps us give that extra bit of theming there that could, you know, just as easily be a purely numerical exercise. But, I mean, again, we wanted it to be vampire, right? So it could have just been a totally abstract numbers game, but once you put those vampire theming elements to it, it really takes on, you know, what better game for a trust and betrayal exercise than vampire? And, you know, you can do it through role-playing, or you can do it through purely playing, you know, Justin the Player says this is the case. And I found, like, a lot of times, it's kind of one of those subsets of LARPers. You know, there are some LARPers who really get into it for the improvisational theater aspect or the intense personal outlook. Well, there are some players who their LARP character is basically them turned to 11. And this sort of lets you do that too.
Exactly right. I personally felt that the slightly abstracted nature actually helps for vampires specifically, because the kinds of characters you're portraying are a little distant from the consequences of their actions, which is why I drew the connection to Eve, because he's the same way. It's like, you know, oh, I'm just this immortal pilot that's going to be constantly reincarnated every time I die. So the actual lives and the ships I'm blowing up and all the things I'm destroying don't really matter as much to me. Even if I'm playing it just by purely results running the numbers, that's still in a way engaging with the world, even if you're not intentionally doing so. Your lack of engagement still propels that world forward. And the same thing with Princess Gambit is that even if you're playing the completely I'm just running the numbers and not really caring about the theming of it, well, then you're still playing the very abstracted elder who no longer is opting into the attempt at humanity. So you're still kind of helping to contribute to the atmosphere even if you're not intentionally doing so. I found that particularly clever.
Yeah, I was about to say that's the humanity 2 vampire out there just moving its pawns across the board with no regard for the lives. You know, and the same in Eve. You know, I'm the pilot, and yes, I'm going to go have my brain dumped back into a new clone, but all of the people who were, you know, on the ship with me, well, I got them killed. But anyway, I had it insured, so who cares?
Exactly right. So we are getting close to time. Is there anything that, Justin, that you wanted to kind of talk about that we haven't covered? Or, Dixie, do you have any questions that I didn't get a chance to get to?
I have a question, because you've worked on so much, Justin, you know, over your career. What have you not gotten to work on that you'd really like to still?
Ooh, that's a good question. I've had a lot of opportunity to work on, you know, I got into to role-playing games when I was, I think, probably 7 years old. Mm-hmm. I played in my cousin's basement.
And oh, hey, same. I was 7.
I started with D&D, I think, which is a lot of people's gateway. Mm-hmm. And I've had the fortune to be able to work on, you know, I did some of the Scarred stuff when White Wolf was doing that. Yeah. And I did the third edition treatment of Ravenloft.
Right.
So, I mean, a lot of the stuff that is really kind of dream project or stuff that I want to do, I've had the luxury to do already, and so I really want to move into, and I haven't had a whole lot of opportunity to devote time to it because my day job is so demanding, but I want to do something wholly original, you know, starting from the ground up and building it and owning it along the way. So I think that's kind of cool that you brought that up, Dixie, on the podcast here, because that's something that I really have enjoyed seeing Eddie do with Pugmire, and Rose do with Cavaliers of Mars. You know, here's something that is basically you own, you know, belongs to you entirely. You get to call all the shots on it. You know, for me, as much as I love Vampire, you know, it got sold to CCP, and I made $0 on that transaction. And it got sold to Paradox, and I made $0 on that transaction. So having spent a lot of my life making this thing valuable for others, I don't get any royalty on it. So, but, you know, I really am looking forward to an opportunity to create something that I not only have full creative control over, but full, like, ownership of. So hopefully I get something like that up and rolling in the future. And there's always, you know, like any designer, like any creative, I have a folder full of a million brilliant ideas that, you know, I just haven't fucking got off my ass to do. So, you know, the doing of that, I think, is really the thing that I want most. The opportunity, the time, and the chance to make something entirely of my own.
That's actually a really cool answer, because I feel like most of our, you know, guests, since we've had developers and writers and stuff on here, a lot of us are still newer in our careers. So I think most people just kind of go like Shadowrun or, you know, whatever, like whatever property they're a fan of. And honestly, I think that most of those people, if they really thought about it, would probably have more pride and more interest doing what you're talking about exactly, in making their own thing. So that's really cool to hear. And I hope you get the chance to. And I hope I get the chance to buy it or work on it or something. So
Yeah, thanks. I mean, that's something like, of course, you always want to kind of get a chance to make your mark on something that got you involved in the hobby. Of course, if you love Shadowrun, you want to do something for it. And I mean, again, I've had the luxury to do that a lot. And so for me, you know, I'm climbing up the Maslow's hierarchy of needs here. I'm trying to get myself up to, you know, self-actualization.
Yep.
So, you know, that's really hopefully what I get to do. So, and I'm also fortunate that I know a lot of really cool and capable people to kind of make that less difficult along the way. Yeah. So knocking on wood here, that's something the future holds for me.
That sounds great. Awesome. So when you eventually announce that product, how would people find you on social media to talk about it?
Oh, I don't know. I keep fighting with myself. I want to get away from that damn Facebook. So right now, I think I'm spending a higher proportionate time over at Twitter, where I am Jay Achille, J-A-C-H-I-L-L-I. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty much Jay Achille everywhere. I have a sorely languishing website at justinachille.com, and I use that typically for kind of longer form explorations or kind of, hey, here's this cool idea I learned about as we were working on whatever. Here's some of the stuff I can share with it. It's really weird now. You know, I work for Ubisoft, and Ubisoft is many, many thousands of people. And back in the day at White Wolf, I was the NDA, you know, like Judge Dredd, I am the law. And now I'm bound hand and foot by NDA, and I, you know, would love to share more about what I do every day. But obviously, you know, that needs to be protected for business interests there. But you know, once we, you know, like talking about some of the data parts of Werewolves Within, you know, that we've shared at ECGC before, or that we showed at VRDC, you know, when I am able to share these things, I really like to do it, because it's like we were talking about earlier, something that I didn't have when I was younger. So if I can help someone's journey into being a designer be a little easier, I love that. You know, I love being able to give back to what I feel has been a very satisfying career to me. So thanks for giving me a chance to sort of flog that there.
Oh, no problem. And if you ever have future insights and you want to come back on the podcast and talk about them, just let us know. Happy to have you on again.
Will do.
So thank you so much for your time, Justin. We really appreciate it.
Yeah,
thank you. It was fun talking.
Thanks, Eddie. Thanks, Dixie.
And we're back.
Hooray! What?
We've been gone for so long.
I know.
It feels it's been a full hour since I talked to you guys.
I've already had two drinks since then.
Oh. I've finished the bottle.
Yes.
You both hold your liquor really well, then. You both sound totally normal.
Well, actually, my roommate recently bought some bottles of whiskey home, and so I was like, ooh, I haven't tried this whiskey yet. So gave me a chance to explore.
We've been collecting the Game of Thrones whiskeys at our place.
Oh, how are those?
I don't know yet, but they're all just repackages of like other whiskeys.
Like
each one's a different brand. But my roommates and I are all big Game of Thrones fans. Well, me and my one roommate, the other one doesn't really care, but she's buying them anyway. So we even got the like color changing Johnny Walker one, where when you put it in the freezer, it gets like the Night's King on it. I don't know. It's cool.
Are they named after the houses? Or
yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we have Targaryen and Stark upstairs right now, and I am hunting a bottle of Tyrell because that's my favorite house. So
nice.
This is not about the interview at all. I don't know what I'm talking about.
We often do this. We often do this in our outros. Oh yeah, and there was an interview.
That was fun. I learned a lot about Justin I did not know. Like, I didn't know all of his outside vampire work as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, I honestly had almost forgotten about the card games from the 90s. I was like, oh, that existed, right?
Right.
And for those of you who aren't familiar with him, he's a really great Twitter follow. He's very funny.
Absolutely. So. He's a lot of fun on social media.
Yeah. Matthew, what'd you think?
I enjoyed it a great deal. It was I'd already heard the Rage stories before, the Rage card game, but it was lovely hearing them again. What one thing that always stuns me is when Justin, or indeed anyone else that worked at White Wolf in the 90s, talks about the ridiculous production schedule for games like Vampire the Masquerade, where there's like 10 books that have to come out in 1 year. And yep. you're the overseer or developer of that particular line. I can only imagine the levels of stress and mania throughout the office at that time. But I suppose it's interesting, isn't it? I suppose in a way, when you're all based in one location, it can become quite industrial, quite process driven, and that has its advantages, definitely, but due to the speed at which books came out, quality control wasn't always the I guess top billing when it came to those books. So there's obviously a huge number of fantastic classics from the revised line, but there are others that people just forget because I guess they didn't stand out quite so much.
Well, yeah. Also, I mean, that's where stuff, you know, back in the old days before we, you know, had everything on our computers and we're cross-checking it and looking at all these, you know, PDFs and design, whatever. Like, that's why we still have jokes about PageXXs getting missed and being put in books, because it was just a lot harder to do a PageXX check, you know?
No, you had to visually look for XXs.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, when I worked on the newspaper in college, we... everything was done through, you know, Word and everything, but then we always did a final visual proof before we sent it off to the press, and things still got missed with, you know, 8 pairs of eyes on it. So I don't know. I think they did really, really cool work back in the day. I enjoyed hearing about it. I like our process now, though.
Yeah. Matthew, I don't know if you got a chance to listen to some of the diving Justin and I did about what it's like to work on Vampire the Masquerade. I was curious.
Yes, I did. And, I mean, did oh, sorry, you carry on. What was your question?
I was just going to say, it's like, yeah, I was wondering, how, since you've kind of, you know, I was the step after Justin, and then now you're the step after me in terms of some of your work on V5 or Chicago and whatnot. Did you find there was some connection there? Did you differ, agree?
I don't know. I don't know if I have so much of a connection there. I quite like the idea that each developer or overseer or whatever you want to call them of Vampire has got a different experience, because I actually saw someone online referring to them in sort of eras recently, and I now have my own era. So there was the Eddie Webb era, there was the Justin Achille era, Andrew Greenberg, and, you know, going back.
Right.
And yeah, and that's quite interesting to me, because it shows it comes through in the way the games look, the books look, and it's interesting to hear about the experiences of yourself and Justin. One of the, I guess, constant pressures of being on such a high-profile game is, of course, the fan expectation and fan reaction. I think we can all say we felt that, especially with, you know, with being on a new edition of a game. You had V20. Well, you and Justin had V20, but obviously you were very much in the seat for that one. And my involvement with V5 and now Chicago and subsequent books that Onyx Path will be putting out leaves me to a lot of fan scrutiny, and that can be unpleasant. It can also be incredibly heartening if people like what you're doing. I guess it's the same with any product, but I'm kind of coming to terms with the idea that in this creative industry, it's much like any other. If, let's say, I was a musician and I was putting out a new single every few months or so. People who have been my fan or a fan of this genre of music for years and years might like what I'm doing just because it's me doing it or just because it's that genre. Or they might say, I don't really like this single very much.
Right.
And, you know, not every single thing you put out is going to be a smash hit, and not every single thing is going to please everyone. And as long as I keep that kind of in mind, I can get through it without too many lost nights of sleep.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the things that I kind of wanted to dig into with the transition to Vampire the Requiem, is that there's also, like you talk about music, that's a good example. A lot of people look back at a body of work and go, oh, I really enjoyed that artist or really didn't enjoy that artist.
Mm.
But in the middle of the release schedule, there's a lot more criticism, because there's a lot of criticism about Revised Era, Vampire at the time. There was a lot of criticism about the changing it to a new edition, universe, however you want to slice that particular thing. And Justin was very heavily involved in that process. So during that time, he got a fair bit of criticism as the guy on the front lines, as it were. But now in retrospect, people go, oh, Justin's great, or we love the Revised Era. And I've been seeing a little bit of that now myself. It's like when I was heavily doing the V20 stuff, there's a lot of, this isn't my Vampire, blah, 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 blah. And then you know, with V5 coming out, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, I really love V20. I think it's great. So, I mean, there's always this kind of backwards glance and usually a beneficial one. It's like, okay, in retrospect, I enjoyed the body of work. And I'm hoping that as you move on and keep doing more stuff, that people go, oh, yeah, actually, I really enjoyed the Matthew Dawkins era, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, I think nostalgia is a good part of that. But doing good work in the moment really helps. And I think all three of us have had a chance to do some good work. But you're right. It's your vampire is very different from my vampire. And it's very different from Justin's vampire.
It's the Doctor Who phenomenon, isn't it? It's your favorite Doctor. Yeah. Your favorite Doctor is always the one you grew up with, or was your first one. For by and large, obviously, there's outliers there, mostly David Tennant. But
right.
Who, you know, seems to be unanimously loved. But I can quite confidently say John Pertwee is my doctor because, not actually my general medical practitioner.
that would be really awkward.
Not since 1993 when he died. That I may have got the year wrong. But yeah, when I was growing up, that was the Doctor Who I watched. It was being repeated. It was the first Doctor Who I watched, and so he stuck with me. Even when the repeats went straight onto Tom Baker afterwards, I never latched onto Tom Baker as well as John Pertwee. And I have no doubt in 10 years' time, when I've moved on to my kingdom in the sky, apparently, there will be people looking back at my work on Vampire and saying, ah, you know, that stuff was pretty good, wasn't it?
You two both keep talking, and I had the best segue earlier, but then Matthew had to talk about Doctor Who. So I'm going to do my segue anyway.
All right. Do it.
Which is, speaking of Matthew Dawkins projects and nostalgia, on Kickstarter right now, we have an awesome game.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Called They Came From Beneath the Sea, which is set in the 50s and B-movies and monsters from beneath the sea, and it's a Matthew Dawkins project. It was the best segue, and then Matthew was like, let me talk about Doctor Who.
Right.
I need all the listeners to forget all the Doctor Who stuff and just instantly insert Dixie segue into your mind.
I was so proud of my segue.
You were. That was a very good one.
I was so proud of it. But yeah, no, y'all check out this Kickstarter. I edited this book and it's super fun. If you like B horror movies, if you like MST3K, which I'm a huge MST3K fan, if you like games that make you laugh while you're fighting monsters and not, you know, aren't super serious all the time, this is really, really fun. So check it out. It is on Kickstarter. It's only been there for like 3 days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're recording this right before it goes live, so I am assuming it is doing well.
I was totally trying to like immerse people and have them think that we were talking to them on the day, and then you just
ruined
blew
it.
That up too.
All right. Well, what we'll do is edit this.
No,
because Eddie, you've said, I'm assuming it's doing really well. It's such a shame it bombed on day one and it got all that negative press on day two, and you know, what with the international incident and all that. So now we can put that in. There you go. We're covered.
We could, or we won't. And now I'm trying to figure out how.
We'll talk about where they came from in a bit more detail in a future episode, but
yeah, let's do that.
Needless to say, it's so I'll say it anyway. The
needlessly.
Yes, it goes without saying, but
and then there's just silence for the next 30 seconds.
It goes without saying, so we won't.
Yes, and notwithstanding, never let it be said. There you go.
And then, you're not even gonna go there. We're done.
Yeah.
So I think we can maybe our Christmas episode will
what
be.
What were you going to say, Matthew? I have to know.
So I was going to say that it's a game that I have spent many, many years developing in my head and through various prototypes. And it is fantastic to see it in its final written version. It is all written. There is nothing else to add to the core book. So if you're backing the Kickstarter, do not despair. Do not worry. There is no more writing to be done. Indeed, if you back the Kickstarter, you will get access to all of the finished text before the Kickstarter concludes, because it's even been edited by our very own fantastic editor superstar, Dixie Cochran. Hello, Dixie.
So, you're saying that because I'm in the room.
Yeah, I am. So it's just...
What a shit you are.
So it's just art and layout, and the Kickstarter is a way of getting the book, I guess, slightly before everyone else, but the main purposes of it are that we would love to get this book into retail, and we would love to be able to fund some stretch goals, and your support on Kickstarter will help us do that. But I am incredibly happy with how it's turned out, and I hope you all check it out and like what you find.
And if people wanted to chat with you about They Came From Need to See, where would they find you guys at? Dixie?
You know, on a beach in Delaware. you can find me at Dixie Cyanide on pretty much all social media and also on the forums for Onyx Path. Also, I want to say happy holidays to everybody if you celebrate, and happy long weekend probably if you don't. And if you have to work, I'm very sorry. I worked in retail for a long time.
Ooh,
I get you.
Matthew?
So if you want to speak to me about it, well, there's a couple of places you can go. As always, I am on my own YouTube channel, The Gentleman Gamer, but as of time of recording, or by the time this is uploaded, I should say, there will be a They Came From Beneath the Sea overview video on the Onyx Path YouTube channel, because I've started uploading content onto there as well. And I invite you to leave your comments questioning this game, my mentality behind creating it, or otherwise go on Twitter or to find me on Clack Click Bang, or the Onyx Path forum as The Gentleman Gamer.
And I will be preparing for my birthday, actually, because it'll be December 24th, so it'll be a few days
Happy birthday, Eddie.
After this records. Thank you. But I'll probably be popping in that online during the break, so you can find me just about anywhere at Eddie Fate, EDYFATE, although I'm done with Tumblr. I talked about it, but I'm not over it. and also if you want to look at my professional stuff, you can find me at Pugsteady, or if you want to find out about Pugmire, that's realmsofpugmire.com. and of course you can always find us generally on theonyxpath.com. If you leave comments on the blog post, we do try to check up on those. So if you have questions, thoughts, episode ideas, smart comments, actually not the smart comments, leave those to yourself, but everything else we do want to hear.
I mean, they're like actually smart comments.
Okay, it's not like intelligent comments. Yes, smart aleck comments, perhaps. we have enough of those ourselves. We don't need any more. Check us out at theonyxpath.com. And as always, many worlds, one path best.